Howdy, regulars. Welcome to Regular Dispatch number 2. Yesterday, I read from Joe Nick's biography of Willie Nelson about when Willie first played the Armadillo World Headquarters here in Austin. And I thought today I might read a little from Eddie's version of the events in his book, titled appropriately enough, Armadillo World Headquarters. I highly recommend the book. It's an incredible read. Amazing stories. Eddie is incredibly colorful. The only thing better would be hearing him tell the tales in his own voice, because he's outstanding. Joe Nick himself is also just an incredible storyteller and full of amazing stories. And it occurs to me, I don't know all that much about him, actually. And some of you probably know nothing about him. So today in the show links, I'm going to drop a few clips of him telling stories or talking about this or that. He's just in, and maybe I linked yesterday to his site. You can go there and see other books he's written, purchase those books. But there's a lot. He's got like a, if it's still there on YouTube, just a random thing. He was describing the Memorial Day flood in Austin, 1981. Pretty great stuff. For now, though, let's read. I'm starting in a chapter called The Great Redneck Hippie Merger in Eddie's book, The Armadillo World Headquarters. Of all the legacies attached to the Armadillo, none compares to its storied role in the rehabilitation of country music. The change, which had begun in the late 60s, was very much like an intervention by friends and family who were determined to save country music from its pious and self-righteous self. A steady stream of local and touring acts flying the country rock flag had been welcomed and nurtured at the Armadillo from the beginning. The Flying Burrito Brothers, one of the early marquee names of the genre, came through for a two-night stand in the summer of 1971. Over the next couple of years, we brought in Graham Parsons, Guy Clark, Goose Creek Symphony, Brewer and Shipley, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Earl Scruggs, and others. Call some of them rockers or folkies who'd added an extra little twang to their rock and roll. Call others hillbilly and country singers who'd let their hair grow long around the same time that their guitar players were swapping finger picking for playing power chords through a twin reverb or a Marshall stack. Willie Nelson had obviously taken note of these things, and he started paying even more attention to them as his dissatisfaction with the Nashville scene grew into a powerful sense of alienation. I don't know exactly when he first thought about playing the Armadillo, but I can tell you exactly when and where my side of the saga began. I was out in San Francisco crashing at the abode of my friend Joe Brown, a member of the expat Texan community. Joe had written some copy for Gilbert Shelton's Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers Underground Comics, a thing that really enhanced his counterculture credibility. As for me, I was trying to make contact with the Grateful Dead and working on moving a few pounds of Mexican weed in order to pay the rent on the Armadillo. The live album Willie recorded at Panther Hall in Fort Worth in 1965 was constantly on the turntable at Joe's place. Most people call it Live at Panther Hall, even though the record says Live Country Music Concert. Panther Hall was a 30,000 square foot former bowling alley shaped like a flying saucer. Willie was still a Nashville cat at the time and had a regular spot on a weekly TV show broadcast from Panther Hall called Cowtown Jamboree. Panther Agogo, which catered to rock and rollers, was also broadcast from there. Shiva's Headband had played there. On the record cover, Willie looks like a Nashville slickster with Brill Cream shiny hair, a clean-shaven face, white shirt, dress jacket, skinny tie, and Fender electric guitar. A closer study reveals details that tell a different story. In place of the studio band, Willie was backed by his regular touring sideman, Wade Ray and Johnny Bush. These road veterans gave the music an immediacy and bite not heard in the usual Nashville schlock of the day. Willie even covered the Beatles Yesterday, nailing the wistfully melodic tune with precision and soul. My friend Joe kept the album on replay because he was trying to get over a bad case of homesickness. But the record worked an even more powerful spell on me. I heard that Willie had left the Grand Ole Opry and was moving from Nashville to Austin. I was determined to find him when I got back to town. I wanted to introduce him to my hippies. Strange how things can work out. A week after I got back to Austin, I was at the Dillo drinking a beer when I turned around and saw the country singer from Abbott, Texas, standing there with his sparkling brown eyes and impish grin. "I've been looking for you," I said. "You just found me," he said. "I want you to play here," I said. "I want to play here," he said. We shook hands and sealed the deal on a 50-50 split of the door. The date was set for August 12, 1972. Willie was 39 and I was 29. Next to him, I felt like a green, wannabe rodeo cowboy trying to stay on the bull until the buzzer went off. People around us recognized him. Some approached in awe. I noticed that he suffered fools gladly, and as long as someone was talking to him, he never broke eye contact. I had noticed the same thing in two other people, Ann Richards when speaking with children, and Muhammad Ali when talking to girls. Joe Nick got some of these details. Willie was accompanied that day by Paul English, his longtime drummer, sidekick, best friend, music publishing partner, business manager, and chief protector. Paul had a big, bright, shiny smile of pearly teeth, exquisitely sculpted sideburns and goatee, and tattoos that looked like the work of a lowrider pinstriping master. He reminded me of a cross between Satan and Zorro. In the past, struggling to survive before he made it, Willie had sold Bibles and vacuum cleaners door to door. He had a calm, non-threatening, almost tender countenance. Paul had run collections for gangsters and pimped, among other things. Both men exuded a sense of Zen calmness, not unlike that of a gunfighter, a meditation guru, or a super slick gambler. Poster artist Michael Priest, newly arrived at Armadillo World Headquarters, came to my office to discuss his first project, which was to be a poster advertising Willie Nelson's first appearance at the Armadillo. "Do you have any ideas about the kind of poster you want?" he asked. Funny, Jim Franklin had never asked my opinion before he made a poster. I told Michael I wanted an image of an old cowboy crying in a mug of beer, with a jukebox in the background playing Willie's song, Hello Walls, and a little picture of Willie on the wall. The next day, Michael brought back that very image. By the way, I have an original of this, too. It's awesome. I'll post a link to something that shows you what it looks like. 3 weeks before Willie's debut, I was performing my MC duties during a rock and roll show, and when I mentioned that Willie Nelson would be performing at the Armadillo, only a handful of people clapped. I repeated the announcement a little louder this time for those who might be hard of hearing. There was very little change in the reaction in the room, so the next time I repeated the information, I added, "Willie is only the Bob Dylan of country music, you hippie assholes." Maybe some of my sense of indignation sunk in because over the next couple of weeks, a buzz began building. On the night of the show, some 400 people paid $2 at the door. Probably half of them were there to see the opening act, Greasy Wheels, but another 100 or so were newcomers to the Dillo. They were Willie's longtime hardcore fans and friends. Considering it was August, the turnout was impressive. I was curious about how our regulars would take to this outsider. I felt that if our long-haired regulars would just listen, they'd recognize the artistry of this great songwriter and performer. Greasy Wheels seemed to be nervous themselves. They rushed through their first set as if being chased by the cops. Considering their history, it could have been more than just nerves. Willie's hair was still cut and styled in the Nashville way, and his face was clean-shaven. By the end of the year, he would be long-haired and bearded. Backstage before the show, he was open and talkative with our house attorney, Mike Tollison, and he let Burton Wilson take all the photographs the photographer wanted. Cool as Frank Sinatra under a Vegas spotlight and calm as a preacher at a nighttime prayer service, Willie led his band up onto our big stage. There were just two of them, Paul English on drums and B. Spears on bass. Willie was still punching pennies then, playing rhythm and lead guitar. Paul English looked splendid, dressed in all black except for the red satin underlining of the black satin cape draping his shoulders. B. Spears wore a headband and moccasins, a look that fit right in with our crowd. The room quickly warmed to Willie, cheering and clapping as the opening bars announced timeless classics such as Crazy, Hello Walls, and Funny How Time Slips Away. Many of the songs had been made famous by others. For some in the audience, it was the first time they had heard the original versions. The arrangements were short and tight with few guitar solos. Only rarely did the band pause between songs. The latter was a trick picked up from Willie's biggest influence, Bob Wills, the icon of Western swing. Bob Dylan, the Shakespeare of my generation, never wrote anything near as honky-tonk cool as Hello Walls. Not even Like a Rolling Stone was as deep as Crazy, which had been such a giant hit for Patsy Cline. Not to pick on Dylan, but he was an aloof Yankee loner. By contrast, Willie was accessible, warm, and friendly. He was a Texan and an Indian to boot. Watching him perform up close, I was more impressed than ever. Willie's piercing gaze seemed to be just as effective from the stage as it was when you were standing next to him. He never blinked, never looked away. He was charming, as always, to the older female fans who were new to the Armadillo, and he won over the hippie chicks, too. The roar from the small gathering grew louder and louder. The feeling of mutual recognition was a two-way affair. The set went long, and it kept on going. The stay-all-night, stay-a-little-longer approach we later came to expect. At one point in the set, Paul got tangled up in his cape, falling backward from his stool, but hardly anyone noticed. Finally, the show came to an end. The music stopped. The house lights came on, and the audience slowly filed out into the parking lot. Even as they were getting into their cars, you could still hear them saying Willie's name. In the next weekend, Austin American Statesman, Joe Gracie, who at this date was still wearing his rock critic hat and writing a weekly rock beat album, not only gave the show a giant nod of critical approval, but saw it as a cultural shift in the making. Willie's Armadillo audience had consisted of, quote, a sizable and sociable crowd made up of the most amazing assortment of country music fans I've ever seen, end quote, Gracie wrote. Ponytails and bouffants, pantsuits and moccasins, gentle amazement, and best of all, mutual understanding. It was a joyous homecoming for Willie Nelson. He played way past normal into the Texas summer night. Everybody there, Saturday night, agreed that it was fine and nodded yes, and we ought to do this a whole lot more, and agreed that Willie looks younger and younger every year. And he does. Townsend Miller, whose weekly country music column ran alongside Gracie's, also praised the show. Willie Nelson's experimental Let's Get Country Music Fans to Mix at Eddie Wilson's Armadillo World Headquarters last Saturday was beautiful, he wrote. He alternated sets with the popular local Greasy Wheels group, and everyone had a ball. Almost everyone had a ball at the picking session that followed the show at the Crest Hotel just across the river, especially country music following UT football coach Daryl K. Royal. Then, in the middle of a two-decade career as the winningest coach in UT history, Royal dearly loved orchestrating picking sessions in motel rooms, living rooms, or wherever. He ran them with a coach's sense of order. No matter who they were, guests were expected to listen with both ears. At one point, Gary Cartwright was singled out by the coach. "Jap, you can stay if you shut up and listen," snapped Royal. "Otherwise, butt out." Cartwright, who happened to be a co-host of the jam session, shut up and hunkered down like a flat-topped freshman shorthorn. Our gang of hippies and Willie's gang of hardcore country fans had communed together over the same music in the same room, finding common bonds at the Armadillo World Headquarters. The world's biggest full-service honky-tonk suddenly had a much larger community of music fans. A great deal has been written about what happened the first time Willie and his band graced the Dillo stage, the conversion that took place, and the history that followed. All I know is that a bunch of people were drawn together by cold beer, cheap pot, and fine music. Willie himself has said that he just saw some people headed somewhere, and he managed to get in front of them. Willie told writer Ed Ward in 1980 that although he wasn't the first country act to perform at the Armadillo, he was the first well-known one to do so. "I knew what kind of audience it was, and I wanted to do it," he added. "It's not like I was a genius or anything." Willie didn't suggest that we were geniuses for booking him either. What he said was, "I think the success of the Armadillo had a lot to do with my becoming successful." Now, I just think that's awesome. On several dimensions and lots of different directions with lots of implications for us. I would love to have seen the Armadillo. I'd been to the city of Austin, I guess, as a kid before it closed, but I can guarantee I was never inside it. I don't think I ever saw it for the outside of it. It was gone by the time I got here. Only pictures. I'm grateful, I suppose, that I got to see both Threadgills before they were gone. I still can't quite believe they're gone. They are gone, and Eddie's sort of now retired, which is crazy. And so there's that. It is a part of Austin lore, the night that Willie played the Armadillo, and famously the Rednecks and the Hippies all getting along. Pretty amazing. I'm not going to read about the armadillo or Willie, or certainly armadillo and Willie, every one of these dispatches. But I started the first two there for a couple of reasons. One, I just happened to start this finally on Willie's birthday yesterday. And Eddie Wilson is one of us. You know, I started sitting on the back deck of Mozart's. I can't remember when, 2007 or 8, something. Often on Friday mornings, just myself. And I told a friend named Rodney that I was doing it, and he started just showing up also. And it was cooler when there was somebody sitting over there. We'd both work along. But then, and I used to kind of bounce around to tell a few. We started, you know, seeing, hey, would other people want to come just kind of hang out? And it bounced around different days, even different locations, but it just became easier to always say, it's going to be Friday. Anybody can show up. We'll be here early in the morning at Mozart's on Lake Austin Boulevard. Started putting the word out. At some point, needed to call something, called it the regulars, so that these people will know to come by the pub someday when I finally get it open. And then at some point, we needed a mascot. We needed some way for people to find us. They would hear about it from somewhere and try to come find us. And Mozart's is a big place, a lot of different deck levels and such, and a lot of groups. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on there at all hours. And so I tried a couple of random things, but they were too random and arbitrary. And Eddie was hanging out with us a fair bit. Incredible storyteller. Just loved to hear him talk about. I mean, he's just got so many stories, not just from these armadillo days either, a whole bunch of more stuff, and a great perspective on Austin and all kinds of stuff. And he's just one of the regulars. And so I went to Waterloo Records, or I happened to be at Waterloo Records, and at the counter, they had a jug of these little vinyl toy armadillos, and I grabbed one and kind of made that the thing. And so it's become a bring-your-own-armadillo kind of situation. There's all kinds of different kinds, coasters and stuffed animals, and nobody's yet brought a full taxidermy one, but I think that'll happen someday. And so it's sort of become our symbol, too. Our mascot, the armadillo, and Eddie, over time, has also brought a lot of his friends to hang out with a little bit. Hank Ulrich has been by a few times. We got to have Bill Narum there. I think Bobby Hederman, who was mentioned yesterday, maybe today too, in Eddie's book. I think he came by a time or two. Danny Garrettson, I think, has come by. So it's been pretty special. And some of the regulars, the people that hang out with us, were at UT or Austin or otherwise, and they can tell the stories about some of the armadillo shows that they were able to see. Pretty awesome. I hope we're not losing too much of Austin as it, you know, layer upon layer continues to get built on top of it. And that'll be a topic of discussion over time. But truly, 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 these dispatches aren't all going to be Austin-specific, music-specific. Certainly, Willie, Eddie-specific, as much as love and revere them. So there's that. I think that's plenty for today, and I'll try to get back at it tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. By the way, if you hear background noise, it's because I'm doing this in a room in a house without a... This is no studio. It's just a regular room. And dogs are barking and kid running around and family doing stuff. And that's just going to be the way that, that it is. Y'all have a good day, good night, and talk to you tomorrow.